Thank you, Paul. Good morning, everyone. Okay, to ease you into the day, I'll give you an update of where we've got to on the revisions and enhancements to the due process. I'll walk you through where we've got to on the revised due process handbook, the protocol tables we've established, and give you a flavour of what's in the feedback statement. Just as a reminder and an introduction, over the past 2 years, the Trustees Due Process Oversight Committee, and I should make an apology here, Scott Evans, who's the chairman of the DPOC, wanted to be here today to present this, but unfortunately he's got other commitments in the USA. So the DPOC reviewed its operating protocol and asked for the existing due process handbooks. There were separate handbooks for the ISB and the Interpretations Committee to be updated. And the updated handbook that's now being published reflects the conclusions of a number of things. The Trustees Strategy Review, the report of which was published in February 2012. The Trustees Review of the Effectiveness of the Interpretations Committee, published in May 2012. And the ISB's agenda consultation exercise, the feedback statement of which was published in December 2012. So we've taken opportunities to reflect the steps that have been taken to have the board and the interpretations committee work more closely together and reflect the DPOC's due process protocol. So we now have one handbook covering both the board and the interpretations committee. The revisions also reflect the enhanced role of the DPOC. They also reflect the changes that have been made to the standards level programme, so with the research programme now embedded at the development phase. It does not cover the review of XBRL due process. That will follow later, and in the next session, Alan will give you an update of where we've got to on the strategy for XBRL. And where we get to on the due process for XBRL will flow from that revised strategy. In terms of what the DPOC did, there was a draft handbook issued for comment in May 2012 with a 120-day comment period. We did have a session at the Advisory Council meeting in June 2012, and the write-up of those discussions and the breakout sessions was presented to the Council in October 2012. They were also presented to the DPOC along with the 51 comment letters that we did get that expressed broad support for the changes, but obviously a fair amount of issues of detail. And the DPOC worked from October through to January 2013, looking at the comments received and how to respond to them. And it made recommendations to the trustees at their Hong Kong meeting in January to publish the revised handbook, and the trustees gave that approval. The revised handbook was actually published on the 18th of February together with a feedback statement and the due process protocol, and everything is available on the Foundation website. Perhaps one thing I should say here is that the former ISB due process handbook did have the Council's operating procedures and terms of reference as an appendix to that document. We haven't replicated that in the revised handbook. The terms of reference and procedures for this council are now a freestanding document and they are available on the website. Our thought was, although given the discussion yesterday, whether there will be changes to the remit and membership of this council is now a matter for debate, but it was more flexible to have it as a freestanding thing so we could put it to the trustees without having to go through a revision to the whole handbook. So that's the main reason why we did that. In terms of what's in the new handbook, Section 1 sets the scene. It sets out the primary objective of the organisation, what the handbook covers and why due process is so important. The main changes we made from the draft issued in May 2012 was to align the wording of the primary objective of the organisation with that as set out in the Trustees' Strategy Review. We clarified the objective of due process to ensure that the board conducts its standard-setting process in a transparent manner, considering a wide range of views from interested parties during the development of standards, and clarifying the role of the staff as assisting the board, the interpretations committee, and the trustees, as well as distinguishing between technical and trustee staff. There were some concerns from respondents as to whether the staff were all powerful, but we've been keen to say it's the board and interpretations committee and trustees' responsibility. If I take my life as a former civil servant into account, civil servants advise, ministers decide, and that's the same with the board, the committee, and the trustees.
You still believe that?
After having no, I never believed it then, but... moving on, in section two, we put in a new section that looked at the trustees' oversight, and in particular that of the DPOC itself, to set out very clearly the roles and responsibilities of the DPOC. Again, we had some comment in that from the handbook. I think there was a broad welcome for the inclusion of that section, and I think the council, when it discussed that, had a similar view as well. Main changes were to clarify that the DPOC's activities are limited to those of due process. It is not our aim or responsibility to try and second-guess the board or the interpretations committee in any way. It's there to check that due process has been complied with, both in letter and spirit. We've included text on the independent staff resource that the trustees have, and that the DPOC has the right to request any information information to be provided to it, and to clarify the transparency of reporting by the DPOC, including that in effect it signs off on its review of due process before any final pronouncement is issued. DPOC had quite a few discussions around the issue of whether it should conduct at least part of its meeting in public session. It decided on balance not to do that, but to enhance the transparency of reporting. So if you look at the reports, the previous two or three DPOC meetings, they've been rather fuller and more comprehensive than those previously. So for the moment, it's an area we'll keep under review, but for the moment we're trying to go for transparency of reporting rather than public session. In terms of Section 3, it sets out the principles of due process, so that's transparency, full and fair consultation, and accountability. In terms of the changes we made from the exposure draft, it's interesting that the exposure draft did not contain a quorum for ISB meetings. You might expect, being a full-time board, that they would have to turn up for everything, but the glossary did. So we specified that there has to be a quorum for meetings, so it's 60% of the members in attendance. That attendance can be by video conference or by conference call. Interesting area, and it relates back to the conversation that we had yesterday, in particular with Francoise, about clarifying what is and what is not a review draft. I think, again, we had fairly extensive discussions on this as to say, well, is a review draft an embedded part of the due process? And I think, given the extensive steps we already have within the due process, the answer was no. It's now specified as being a draft for editorial review. So it's to give to reviewers to say, look, is the wording clear? Does it reflect the decisions that the board has made? Now, that doesn't sort of stop the board on particular projects by saying, we think there's a need for a review draft, but we're not saying it's a mandatory extra step that you have to go through. In terms of comment letter analysis, the handbook emphasises that it's the strength of the analysis and the evidence provided in comment letters that takes priority. But the exposure draft said that a numerical analysis is not normally provided, and there was a fair amount of pushback on that. And we've put in to say, well, there could be circumstances in which numerical analysis may be useful. Did the investors who responded, for example, reflect a clear view or divergence of views? Are there particular issues coming from any particular sector or geographical region that might be quite useful? And I guess as a warning from time to time on some consultations, has there been a write-in campaign? If you think back to IFRS 8, for example, the publish what you pay people engineered a lobby in effect. So that's there as additional useful information. In terms of the technical work programme in Section 4, this section outlines how the ISB considers potential candidate projects, in particular the 3-year agenda consultation and the research programme, which is now in place and up and running, and Alan referred to some of the issues in the research side yesterday. The main change is from the ED is that we've clarified that while the focus of any agenda consultation is still on the strategic direction of the ISB's work programme, we think there should also be scope to seek views on areas of financial reporting to which the ISB should give priority. Or on the flip side, suggestions as to whether there's projects that should be withdrawn. Sometimes we've seen issues sitting on the work plan for years, where progress has stalled. You might think of IAS 37 liabilities and that exposure draft of notoriety. And if it's going nowhere, then there's the opportunity as part of that agenda consultation to say, let's just take it off. In terms of Section 5 standards level programme, this outlines how projects get selected, whether as comprehensive programme projects or implementation and maintenance. What we've tried to do in changing from the draft handbook is to include an introduction to clarify the distinction between comprehensive and implementation and maintenance projects, clarify the criteria for comprehensive projects so it's focusing on users' needs while taking into account the costs of preparing financial reports, clarifying that there's a range of solutions available for implementation projects, so it could be minor or narrow scope amendments, annual improvements and interpretations, and particularly important to clarify that rejection notices from the Interpretations Committee should not be confused with an IFRS or interpretation or be perceived as being mandatory. Now this, I think, reflects some of the discussions that the Council had back in June 2012. I mean, I think as Paul made clear in one of his summing up of the group discussions, the distinction between comprehensive and implementation and maintenance is not always that clear cut, so it's more of a judgment call at times than a science, and there is a difficulty of coming up with clear cut criteria. I guess the issue is that whether it's comprehensive project or implementation and maintenance, there will be a consultation, there will be a proper due process and going out to get public views. One issue that we did discuss, and it's particularly relevant to the Council, is that for comprehensive projects, this Council has to be consulted in advance. For implementation and maintenance narrow scope projects, that wasn't referred to. And some people said, well, should the Council at least be informed of projects that are coming through? And we've actually built that in to the handbook itself. In meetings with the trustees, Paul, I think, has been quick to say that if this Council thinks that the Board has miscategorised a project, this body won't be slow in coming forward to tell the Board that. Moving on to Section 6 for new or amended standards, it outlines the process of developing and publishing exposure drafts, developing final proposals and post-implementation reviews. Main changes from the handbook are that there was a proposal set out in the exposure draft to say that the minimum comment period for a narrow scope re-exposure would be 60 days. Fair amount of pushback on that, and in discussion the DPOC has gone for 90 days. I suppose one of the issues is that one person's narrow scope is another person's major amendment, but let's see how that goes. We also looked at clarifying the criteria for re-exposure, and the handbook now makes clear the fact that there are changes proposed from an exposure draft, and inevitably there will be changes, does not compel of itself the ISB to re-expose the proposals. It still has to go through the thought process of saying, do we have to re-expose? And there are re-exposure criteria embedded in the handbook that the Board needs to consider. Again, there's a fear that re-exposure is getting embedded as yet another due process step. We're going for a second re-exposure on leases, second re-exposure on insurance contracts. Is that going to end up being the norm? Ideal, no, only when it merits it. On interpretations, this section outlines the process followed by the committee in developing a draft and then a final interpretation. We've aligned the re-exposure criteria for the Interpretations Committee with that for the Board itself. Section 8 looks at perceived breaches of due process, and it outlines the protocol for trustee action when a complaint about the due process comes in. The main changes from the draft are that we're seeking to address concerns that it's the technical staff who write the report on complaints. Some people said it should either be the Board itself or the trustee staff. The issue is that the technical staff involved with the project are those who are most closely involved with it, and so they know the project more intimately. But Hans and Ian attend every DPOC meeting and have to answer for the Board at those DPOC meetings. I also have the ability to review the reports that are written for the DPOC and can add my own flavour to it for the committee. And the committee itself can turn round and say, we want more information. They can request, as I said earlier, any information they want. The section also now clarifies that when the committee concludes that a breach of due process would not question the decisions already made for the Board, it is required to make its conclusions and discussions public through transparent reporting. And that goes with what I said earlier about the fuller reporting coming from the committee. It also clarifies that if a due process complaint relates to a project where the ISB has yet to issue a new or amended standard, the Board cannot complete that phase of the project in progress until the complaint's been addressed, by the DPOC. Now, that places responsibility on the DPOC to look at those complaints and seek to address them in a timely manner so as not to hinder the effective operation of the Board. However, where a new or amended standard has already been issued, that pronouncement shall remain valid until the complaint's been addressed by the DPOC. Let's just hope it doesn't come to that.
I might just interject in this last point, because you may recall that some council members had expressed a worry that a standard could be issued in a number of countries that makes it part of their law. It triggers a lot of legislative and other regulatory processes, and there was a concern that to then have an aspect of due process arise and potentially question the ongoing status of a standard was troublesome. And I just want to assure Council that the Due Process Committee considers that point very, very carefully. I've been invited to attend a number of their meetings, and I can assure you it's a heavy-duty working committee. They did deliberate the pros and cons. And my recollection is the trustees just weren't comfortable at the end of the day, regardless of the timing, saying, sorry, it's too late. We're not going to consider the merits of your complaint.
And yep.
I think the hope is that this will be a rare circumstance, indeed, if it happens at all. But there was a reluctance, I think, to dismiss the possibility at hand. We had suggested putting in a drop-dead date. So, only got 30 or 60 days after the board has approved a standard, but before it goes effective to complain.
I think on that drop-dead date idea that I think some council members had suggested, I mean, the DPOC did consider that carefully, but then it's very difficult to say, well, you've got 120 days to get your complaint in. If it comes in on the 121st day, tough. I think more reassuring is what I said earlier, is that the DPOC effectively will sign off on the due process before any pronouncement comes out. So the idea is that the committee will go through the due process life cycle of the project to be reassured before the standard or the major amendment comes through. And that, I hope, will help to avoid the situation where this could happen. In terms of the protocol, this was exposed with the handbook as an appendix, and I think it caused a fair amount of comment to say, oh, it all looks very bureaucratic, in terms of the tables that were part of the appendix 4 of the exposure draft. I think we're confirming in this final version of the handbook, and the protocol is not part of that. It's separately on the website. It's not an integral part of the handbook. It's a reporting template for the staff to demonstrate to the board and to the DPOC how the ISP and the Interpretations Committee have met their due process requirements. It outlines metrics for the board and committee to evidence the due process compliance and effectiveness. For transparency purposes, the tables are on the public website, and that's part of the wider revamp of the project-related information that's presented on the web. If you look at the revamped project pages now, you will see for each stage there's a little link saying due process steps. Reports on due process are being sent to the board. These tables go as appendices to the reports. So in effect, they are a bit of a checklist for the staff to say, have we covered everything? Yes. And then you'll see in the covering report, the narrative that tells the story raises issues about any pinch points that the board and the DPOC should be aware of. The DPOC gets those same reports at the same time as the board and has a chance to comment. We're hoping that the revised system will allow users to track a project through its full life cycle, in particular through the project pages of what goes to the board, and we'll be looking to revamp the DPOC section of the website. So if you're interested at coming at it from the DPOC end of things, you can track it back. Easier said than done. But that's an example. Sorry, it's a very crowded slide. But as I say, it's already in use, and I think it's working quite well. I think when the council discussed this in breakout, there was a concern that the forms do not express any form of conclusion as to whether due process has been complied with. That's true. The tables themselves don't. It's the covering narrative in the reports that go to the board and the DPOC that give those conclusions and the factors that make the staff believe that due process has been complied with. In terms of the feedback statement, again, that's on the website. That summarises the consultation that has taken place, the main views expressed by respondents, and how we've responded to those views that were expressed. Some of the highlights raised. In terms of section two, we described the role and objectives of the DPOC. Some respondents suggested, well, should that be in the constitution of the foundation rather than the handbook? We took the view that the constitution is a very high-level document. It says that the trustees shall, you know, oversee the due process of the board and the interpretations committee. But we thought this was at a more operational level, because if the trustees wanted to amend the way it goes about it, it's easier to do that through amending the handbook than one of the five yearly reviews of the constitution itself, or having a specific review of the constitution to address that. The concern about due process being too bureaucratic, I think, was a concern about the due process protocol being included with the handbook. And now, you know, we've separated those two and made it clear what it is. The handbook also specifies that the DPOC must operate in a way that enhances rather than hinders the efficient operation of the ISP while maintaining its independence. The handbook refers to the importance of cooperation and coordination with national standard setters and regional bodies on outreach and due process, but the trustees don't think that can be exclusive. All parties should retain the ability to undertake their own outreach and due process where they believe it necessary. On post-implementation reviews, a number of commentators said, well, why don't you follow the model that's followed in the States, where the Financial Accounting Foundation, rather than the FASB, undertakes post-implementation reviews? We considered that, but have gone for a different view where the board undertakes the post-implementation review itself, but in a very transparent way. So all the board papers on the review of IFRS 8, which is the first one underway, are available. The academic research that's been looked at, you can track that through from the board papers. And I think when you see the final report, that will be a very transparent report of saying what we did and how we did it. I think we're confident that the transparency of the process will protect its integrity. And of course, all the way through, you still have the DPOC giving its oversight. And as I mentioned earlier, instituting a time limit for due process complaints DPOC thought this would be impractical. So that's where we are. It's all available on the website. If anyone's got any questions, I'm happy to try and answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Any questions, David? Comments? Christoph.
Only one quick, maybe very theoretical question. Could someone prevent the issuance of a standard by simply sending one complaint after the other?
That's basically what happened.
I think we quickly sussed that one out, or that's at least the hope. I suspect that once, we take complaints very seriously and go through them in some intimate detail, as Hans and Ian know from attending DPOC meetings. So I think if someone comes back again, there's then a judgment call for the committee to say, well, how fully have we gone through this? And if it satisfies itself that it has, and that the board has properly answered those concerns, then I think it's to say, well, we hear what you say, you just don't agree with the outcome. And sometimes you get complaints coming, it's not so much a complaint about the due process, it's just that they don't like the decision that the board has made.
But I do think, David, one of the things we'll have to do is to ensure there's an awareness of the significance of the sign-off by the Due Process Oversight Committee, because I think what you're saying, and the trustees believe will be the case, is that once the committee has signed off, saying it's satisfied based on the assurances it's received from the board, it's going to be highly unlikely. You're essentially saying they erred in that judgment. So I think once that message is out and about, to the extent that there's hate mail that hasn't already come in, that will be the effective trigger point, I would think.
It will take some work to make
people not dismiss this as an internal process.
It puts the responsibility on the committee to undertake a full and proper process in that review.
Critical step in the overall process. Other comments, questions? Anne?
Yes, I just have a question regarding, I've got in mind the establishment, for example, of the Japan office. Is it envisaged that more of the meetings people might attend, more of the ISB meetings or more of the trustees meetings, people will be attending remotely? Because then it comes to the due process handbook. How is that dealt with in the handbook? Because in some environments I've been in, we've had legal issues with quorums, continuity of attendance, record keeping about decisions that are taken and who's taken what decisions, paper circulation, and what you do in the failure of technology. Does the DPOC, does the handbook cover all those sorts of issues regarding meeting due process, if you like, remotely?
I think our expectation is that the issue is that for board meetings, every board member will attend. There are circumstances where one may not be there for part of the meeting, but it is a full-time board. With the Interpretations Committee, obviously they're part-timers and come for the six meetings a year. I don't think we've ever had an issue with the quorum for physical attendance. We have built in, as I say, that you could be in attendance remotely. And in terms of transparency of meetings in general, this is a raw point because we had issues with webcasting on the last board meeting with some problems. But in general terms, the webcasting and the recording has worked, and we need to check the technical resilience of the technology to make sure that it continues to work after the problems we had in the last board meeting. So I think it's more a theoretical concern than a real one. If it gets to be a real one, then we'll need to look at that at the time.
But the board could not possibly work well if we had per meeting four or five people attending by phone. That doesn't work well. And usually everybody's there. Sometimes we have the absence of one or two people, but then they will attend by telephone usually. But then, for example, the Japanese board member is always expected to be in London for the board meeting.
Jeff, did you have a point?
Thank you. I believe that the bullet point, the second bullet point on slide 15 is very important about concern about due process being too bureaucratic. My question is there a periodic review to determine whether or not some of the due process steps might be eliminated since they don't provide much value? I think that would be an important part of the review process. Does that exist?
Well, having just gone through the review, we're clear that it's we're trying to be extensive without being over bureaucratic. Now, Anthony might have a view, feeling that there's endless due process, but it is something we will keep under review. I guess one thing we will do is periodically review how it's working out in practice and then take steps either to, well, it could work either way, either to eliminate something if we feel it's not adding value or bring in something if there's a real issue. I don't think so, because of the extensiveness of the due process we've got, it's more likely elimination than issue.
Well, I must say that generally speaking, I don't think the board feels that the due process is constraining, because it's really what you want to do if you want to do a good job. What we have more questions about is where we go on top of due process. Like if it's going to be a norm indeed that we expose everything twice, then we're going to have a problem. But in terms of the due process itself, I really don't think it's constraining us in doing our job properly. No, it helps.
Joel.
One minor point on the due process oversight committee role. At times it seems like there are comments on an area that end up in the trustees' hands, and the trustees would take the issue on in private without public exposure. I think around perhaps even the ASAP there was that element, and I wonder whether there's some some connection that we might make to the trustees even in their due process that is covered by the due process oversight committee.
It's a fair point. Well, of course, in doing the due process handbook, which is the trustee responsibility, we've tried to sort of go through due process properly ourselves. I mean, in terms of what happened with ASAF, and you give that as an example, what we've tried to do, even though a lot of the discussion was done in private, Michelle Prada sort of reflects this in the public session, so you'll see from the report of the trustees' meeting that is on the website, we've tried to be fairly full about the discussion that took place there.
That's a good example, Joel. Quite a bit of the trustees' discussions are in private for good and valid reasons, but my sense is they've erred on the side of caution. If they sensed there was a larger issue that warranted having a broader perspective, for example, they have invited me on behalf of counsel not only to attend the due process oversight committee meetings, but when the trustees discuss the ASAF proposals, they reached out to me to make sure that the council had an opportunity to, or a representative of the council, to be there to hear the discussion and to participate. So, it's not a full response, but I think it seems to be working reasonably well. Any other comments or? Otherwise, David, congratulations. I think like due process, like anything, you can always add more. It's hard to know when you've reached the point where there's too much, but my sense would be the refinements in this process indeed are a welcome enhancement, perhaps a codification to some extent of practice as it has evolved. And maybe we just put a marker down relative to Joel's point. At some point, we need to ask ourselves whether the transparency around the trustees' operations are what they would want it to be. Is that a fair comment? All right. Well, thank you very much for that. Alan, shall we move to